The question of the meaning of life is a timeless philosophical concern. Rooted deep in the human heart, it has been explored by great philosophers including Plato and Aristotle, Augustine and Aquinas, Pascal and Rousseau, Kant and Marx. It is so fundamental a question, it has occupied intelligent minds from outside of formal philosophical circles, by pastors and men of letters, by essayists like Montaigne and Emerson, by poets like Virgil and Dante, Milton and Shakespeare. Indeed, one could hardly count as an educated person without having surveyed history's rich variety of answers to the question of the meaning of life. Just to ask the question is to participate in a fundamental human quest. Okay, what I just said is the kind of thing that's been said many times before in books and in articles, in academic and popular venues. You've probably heard it before.
Did you write this paper?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
This is for you. I wrote it for you. You can interrupt me, by the way. I don't mind. What I just said is so familiar as to be trite. It's also entirely false. Every single claim I made, false. The question of the meaning of life is not a timeless philosophical concern. No character in a Platonic dialogue ever asks about the meaning of life. No Aristotelian treatise considers it. No homily or tract by Augustine addresses it. Aquinas never formulated a quaestio about the meaning of life. None of the people I name, not Pascal or Rousseau, Kant or Marx, Virgil or Dante, Milton or Shakespeare, Montaigne or Emerson, not one of them ever wrote about the meaning of life. One could study almost all of intellectual history and never come across the question of the meaning of life. To think of intellectual history in terms of that question is, in the best case scenario, a valiantly creative revisionism. More likely, it's just sloppy naivete. The historical record simply does not support the idea of a fundamental human quest for the meaning of life. The question of the meaning of life has a particular and very short recent history. It's a 19th century invention. Before about 1850, almost nobody asked about the meaning of life, and even then, it barely gained any attention. The question of the meaning of life was asked only in fits and starts through the later 19th century, until it took hold at the beginning of the 20th century, and it was only then that past thinkers were reinterpreted through the lens of this new, very late modern question. Even when the phrase, the meaning of life, originally entered the English language, it seems to have been as part of a joke. As far as I've been able to tell, the first known English use of the phrase was by Thomas Carlyle in a book called Sartor Resartus in 1834. Have you ever heard of this book? It's a very, very strange book. It was influential in its day. This book imagines a fictional philosopher. His name is Diogenes Teufelsdruck, which means devil's filth in German. And Diogenes Teufelsdruck is the author of a treatise on philosophy focusing on the importance of clothing. Sartor, like sartorial. So clothing reclothed in Latin is the title of this book. A fictional narrator tries to make sense of Teufelsdruck's work, which includes the following reflection. So here I'm quoting Carlyle. "Temptations in the wilderness," exclaims Teufelsdruck. "Have we not all to be tried with such? Not so easily can the old Adam lodged in us by birth be dispossessed. Our life is compassed round with necessity. Yet is the meaning of life itself no other than freedom, than voluntary force. Thus have we a warfare, in the beginning especially a hard-fought battle, for the God-given mandate work, though in well-doing, lies mysteriously written in Promethean, prophetic characters in our hearts, and leaves us no rest, night or day, till it be deciphered and obeyed, till it burn forth in our conduct a visible, acted gospel of freedom." So that's Carlyle narrating, a fake English professor narrating a fake German professor talking about the meaning of life. Freedom, necessity, interior restlessness and struggle, the self's attempt to transcend the world. Carlyle was writing a send-up of German idealism. There are genuine redeemable insights here, to be sure, about the challenge of human freedom, insights that we will later come to associate with existentialism. But Carlyle has the narrator criticize this particular passage as an ambitious figure, and the philosopher's work generally as pompous and vague. Nothing but innuendos, figurative crochets, a typical shallow, fitfully wavering, prophetico-satiric, no clear logical picture. If there is a timeless, universal question about human life, do we really want to trace it back only this far to a comic stunt, a parody of philosophy, a fictional, crazy German pronouncing about the meaning of life? Now, at this point, you may be wondering if I'm pressing too hard on a narrow, pedantic, and purely linguistic point. Even if the particular phrase, the meaning of life, has a short history, surely that phrase captures a common underlying idea about the significance of the human condition. And surely there is something rather universal about the quest for this, whatever particular label we might put on it in one age or another. My answer to this suggestion is, first, even if the phrase the meaning of life is only a novel linguistic phenomenon, it is one reflected not only in English. The emergence of a formulation for the meaning of life was a general Western phenomenon, occurring during the same specific period in all major European languages. We should be curious why it emerged, and what else might have accompanied its emergence. What prompted people to speak in terms of the meaning of life when they had never done so before? And further, given that it is a new phrase, we must face the possibility that the new phrase signifies a new concept or a whole new framework of concepts. And we should ask what concept or framework of concepts might have preceded this phrase, which the use of this phrase might have competed with or even replaced. If people didn't used to talk about the meaning of life, what question did they once ask instead? And what does it say if today we might no longer be asking that question? We cannot and should not assume that behind the phrase the meaning of life, in whatever language, there is some common idea that was formerly expressed in other terms. It would be a rash assumption in need of evidence that the quest for the meaning of life has appeared in times and places that never knew such a phrase. There's a general point here about philosophy and history and language. When we try to make sense of views held today and views held by people in the past, we must be careful to clarify not just the theories being advanced, but the questions being asked to which those theories are being offered as answers. Not just particular answers, but the range of potentially intelligible answers change as the formulation of a question changes. And so it could hide something important about the development of human ideas to automatically assume that answers offered to one formulation of a question can be simply translated into what would count as intelligible answers to a very differently formulated question. What license have we to assume that ideas about the meaning of life make sense as answers to universal fundamental questions about the human condition, if universal fundamental questions about the human condition have, for most of history, never been formulated in terms of the meaning of life? At the very least, the burden of proof should be on those who would assert equivalency. My title is How Not to Ask About the Meaning of Life. Looking ahead, what I will be arguing is simply don't. Ask something else. Put another way, the right way to ask about the meaning of life is not to ask that question, but to ask another question. Or to put it yet another way, those who are most insistent on asking about the meaning of life may, by formulating that question, be cutting themselves off from the only kind of inquiry that could, in fact, satisfy their actual human longing, a longing which should be framed in some terms very much different from the meaning of life. So here is my plan. I will proceed by reviewing in more detail the emergence of the question of the meaning of life. Then I will describe what alternative earlier question it more or less displaced. Then I will consider the different assumptions and implications of these two questions with a view to understanding why it matters which of the two questions one asks. And finally, I will consider a very distinctive and very thoughtful attempt to bring these two questions into conversation, an attempt which I think only confirms that the only intelligible way to ask about the meaning of life is to recover and ask again a very different sort of question altogether. Understand the plan now? Got your attention? So let us try to understand the emergence of this new phrase and this new question about the meaning of life. As I've said, it's not just in English that this entirely new phrase appeared suddenly in the 19th century and took hold in the 20th. In every major language I have checked, the notion of the meaning of life is a 19th century invention. In German, Der Sinn des Lebens is sometimes said to have been first formulated by Nietzsche in 1875. Thanks to Google, I've found scattered, apparently uninfluential uses of it as early as 1811. There's an 1825 play in German that uses the phrase and a work of political history in 1811, but these don't seem to have been particularly influential. In French, Le Sens de la Vie was the title of an 1889 moralistic novel by Edward Rode. The phrase seems to have had little use before then, and it may have come into French through Russian influence. Leo Tolstoy seems to have popularized the relevant Russian phrase, I won't try to pronounce that one, especially in his Confession. I have found no example of that phrase in Russian before the publication of Confession in 1882. Edward Rode, the French novelist, probably read Confession. He and Tolstoy corresponded and shared a critique of Schopenhauer's pessimistic reflections on the meaninglessness of life. So this French and Russian connection points in the same direction as Carlyle's joke, that the question of the meaning of life has its roots in the legacy and critique of German idealism. It is perhaps not incidental that the question of the meaning of life seems to have been first formulated in order to articulate an essentially negative answer. The question appears to have arisen as a way of making intelligible, even if only for the purpose of escaping, the threat of meaninglessness. The articulation of the question reflects a felt need to overcome a pessimistic or negative view about human life, the kind of answer implied by materialism, positivism, and the scientific critique of religion. Kierkegaard was reflecting on the meaning of life in Danish Meningen med livet in the mid-1800s, but even his positive answer was in response to the looming possibility of the negative alternative, that life was meningslost, meaningless. In any case, from these scattered philosophical references, the question of the meaning of life finds its home in a certain kind of late modern discourse, romantic, existential, psychological, aesthetic, populated as much by poets and artists as by philosophers and theologians. The phrase is used by Freud and Spengler, by Thomas Mann and William James, by Camus and Sartre, Virginia Woolf and the Bloomsbury set. Even those who propose a positive answer, advancing something satisfying as the meaning of life, seem to feel the pressure of a looming, barely escapable negative answer that perhaps life is meaningless or absurd. It would perhaps be permissible shorthand then to say that the question of the meaning of life is an existentialist question, and as such, about as historically contingent as existentialism itself, a philosophical movement rooted in particular cultural circumstances. True, existentialism claims to get at universal questions of human life, but it is a feature of existentialism that it articulates those questions in terms of the meaning of life, and related questions like the meaning of suffering, the meaning of death, the meaning of freedom, or finding meaning in life, all of them questions of meaning instead of some other sorts of questions. Interestingly, the question of the meaning of life, although new, did not grow into a proper new field or subdiscipline in philosophy. To the extent that it survived outside of existentialism, it was subsumed under ethics where it was taken to be commensurate with previous questions of ultimate moral concern. We've mentioned its role in novels and plays. At the same time, and perhaps ironically, the meaning of life also came to be adopted outside of philosophy and literature by the social sciences as a neutral, objective way to characterize certain phenomena, individuals and cultures finding value or direction. Treating questions that might have traditionally been thought of as having religious or moral stakes, instead, as questions of the meaning of life, allowed the social sciences to attend to the powerfully value-laden dimensions of human experience without taking sides, indeed pretending that it's possible and preferable to avoid taking sides in answering those questions. It will be interesting to see how much longer the question of the meaning of life survives. By the late 20th century, in popular discourse, the phrase "the meaning of life" has attained or reverted to joke status. It's the name of a Monty Python movie. Do people still watch Monty Python movies? There's a glib answer to it in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. What's the meaning of life?
42.
I love that. Today, it has the tone more of corny and pretentious, being corny and pretentious more than earnestly philosophical. Later this month, Kelly Clarkson's new album is going to drop. You know what it's called? The Meaning of Life. You're all going to listen to that. Whatever its fate, the history of the meaning of life question is clear. Far from being a timeless, eternal, fundamentally human question, the question of the meaning of life is a contingent social construct, a very particular and very recent invention. Culturally and politically, its context is one of uncertainty and secularism. The connotation of the question is subjective, and the implicit pressure to answer it is the weight of pessimism and doubt. It is hard to escape the impression that the question of the meaning of life only emerges in response to political, intellectual, and social conditions that otherwise suggest that life is meaningless. What, then, did people wonder about before they wondered about the meaning of life? This is not difficult to answer. The question about human life asked for most of Western history up into the 20th century is not about the meaning of life, but about the goal, or the good, or the end of life. The question was most commonly formulated in terms of the end of man, or man's chief good, where man is obviously a gender-neutral term for the human species. The Greeks called it the telos, Latins summum bonum, or ultimus finis, highest good, or ultimate end. We may call it the question of the purpose of life, where by purpose we don't mean an individual agent's intention or conscious sense of purpose, but the intrinsic essential why of the species. What are human beings for? What is the ultimate point of our existence? This is the question that dominates the center and largest of three parts of Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologiae. Question one of the first part of the second part is on man's last end, and the following several hundred questions by Aquinas examine all that is entailed in answering that question. The question of man's purpose or end is addressed in Augustine's City of God and Confessions. It's the question that motivates Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Many of Plato's dialogues consider the human good or end explicitly, like Republic or Philebus, and those that don't can easily be read as relating their subjects, virtues, laws, speech, knowledge, pleasure, friendship, love, death, everything that Plato ever talked about, relating those things to the question of the human good. The tone could be said to be set by Greek drama. Could we imagine trying to interpret Sophocles' Antigone as a meditation on the meaning of life? Hardly. It is clearly and forcefully about the end or good of human life. Even the great Western stories about a particular character finding his personal path, the Iliad and Odyssey, the Aeneid, the Divine Comedy, all of these only make sense as reflections on human nature and the pursuit of the human good. It would seem to trivialize them to try to force them into the paradigm of exploring the meaning of life. Into the 19th century, even as the new question of the meaning of life was beginning to be formulated, the question of an intrinsic human purpose remained dominant in secular and religious contexts. When Thoreau set out to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, he did so explicitly questioning the Catechism's answer to the chief end of man. He quoted it, but still in pursuit of his own alternative answer to that question. I can't find Marx speaking of the meaning of life, although he did formulate his materialistic anthropology in terms of the purpose of life. Herbert Spencer, even while articulating a utilitarian ethics grounded in positivism, still speaks of human nature and human purpose. The question of life having meaning does not arise for him. The purpose of life was quite explicitly the primary pedagogical question of Catholic instruction. Major 19th century Catholic thinkers like John Henry Newman and Orestes Brownson never asked about the meaning of life, but frequently spoke of the end of man or the chief good of man. And, of course, the very first lesson of the 1885 Baltimore Catechism, the starting point from which it proceeded to instruct in the essentials of faith, was entitled, the end of man. And it even glossed that phrase further as the purpose for which he was created. To suppose that the question of the meaning of life is a timeless universal question is to insist that it captures what is formulated in terms of the question about man's ultimate end or good or purpose. I think this would be very hard to sustain. The question of the purpose of life, if taken seriously, is intrinsically teleological and essentialist. That is, it presumes that there is such a thing as true human fulfillment, rooted in human nature, which reflects a definite purpose or intention of its maker. In Aristotelian terms, the question of purpose implicates three of the four causes. In asking about the end of man, final cause, it presumes that there is an essential human nature, formal cause, which has been communicated to man from an agent, an efficient cause. Put another way, to ask about the purpose or end of human life is at once to create a field for practical moral questions. How should we live? For what end should I act? And to frame that field in the context of fundamentally metaphysical questions. What is the true origin, nature, and destiny of human beings? This is exactly what we see reflected in the design of the whole of Aquinas' Summa Theologiae, which places the moral reflection of the second part, which I've already mentioned, in relation to God as creator of human nature, explored in the first part, and who alone can lead us to the fulfillment of our end, as explored in the third part. That's the whole Summa right there. It's the answer to the question of the origin, nature, and destiny of human beings. By contrast, the question of the meaning of life almost seems formulated precisely to avoid both the moral field and the metaphysical frame. Meaning is subjective, placing an emphasis on the interior life, feelings, emotions, awareness, consciousness. What makes me feel purposive doesn't necessarily speak to the question of an intrinsic essential purpose. Meaning does indeed suggest directionality. Something is meaningful or significant if it makes reference to something else, but this is not the directionality of action towards an end. Rather, it's the directionality of the symbol to what is symbolized. To ask about the meaning of life is almost to ask an aesthetic question. What will my life evoke? What will it represent? As a consequence, notice what questions further arise after we open up the question of the meaning of life. Is it the same for everyone, or a matter of individual perspective? Do we make meaning, or discover it? Do we entertain the possibility that there is no meaning? If my life feels meaningful to me, is it really meaningful? These are existentialist questions, questions of real moral seriousness, to be sure, but raised from a position disconnected from a moral or metaphysical framework. By contrast, notice what further questions arise from the question of the purpose or end of life. Where does it come from? How can I achieve it? Is this or that action compatible with it? These are questions of theology and ethics, questions of moral seriousness strongly rooted in a metaphysical framework. The question of life's meaning places an emphasis on subjective fulfillment. The question of life's purpose can include that, but relates the notion of personal fulfillment to a question that draws one outside of oneself. What is my life for? How can I bring my life into its intended order? It's the difference between asking what might happen to make me feel fulfilled given my circumstances, and asking what should fulfill me in light of the true structure of reality. So consider the kind of answers one could give to the old, more permanent question about the goal or end of life. Virtue, happiness, union with God, life everlasting. Why did God make you? God made me to know him, to love him, to serve him in this world, and to be happy with him forever in heaven. Anybody recognize where that's from? That's the beginning of the Baltimore Catechism, which, like the Summa, could use the question of human purpose to structure an entire instruction in Christian wisdom. Do answers like this even make sense as answers to the question of the meaning of life? One would have to say, in Kierkegaardian fashion, only if you choose to make the leap of faith, to believe those answers, to make them meaningful for you. Alistair MacIntyre, in trying to articulate an Aristotelian teleological approach to ethics, has described the need to make life intelligible in the form of a narrative. This might sound like it is a version of making life meaningful, although McIntyre strongly denies an easy equation between Aristotelian purpose and existential meaning. Simply finding meaning cannot be the telos of human life. Here's a quote from McIntyre. It's not meaning as such, nor coherence as such, that we have to achieve, but that very specific type of meaning and coherence which belongs to the lives of those to whom it is given to stand before God. McIntyre admits that if one is not aware of a purpose in one's life, one will feel that one's life is meaningless. But, he says, to say that a life that does not embody movement towards the telos may be found meaningless is not to say that the goal of living a meaningful life ever is or could be the telos or goal of a human life. McIntyre is even willing to allow that Kierkegaard, for instance, did have a teleological view of life. Kierkegaard thought that there was a purpose to life. Where Kierkegaard departed from Aristotle was in his understanding of how one conceptualized one's actions as oriented towards the telos. McIntyre appeals to narrative as a kind of rationality. Kierkegaard was eager to place the conceptualization of meaning outside of rationality. For Kierkegaard, man's fundamental motives are more a matter of non-rational psychological mechanisms. Hence, Kierkegaard's ethical reasoning is closer to aesthetic feeling than to more familiar forms of rational intelligibility. So it is not a surprise that even when taken seriously as the ultimate question of human life, it is widely recognized that the question of the meaning of life is highly personal. Unlike the question of the end of man, which is a general question about the essential good of human nature as such, the question of the meaning of life is individualistic and particular. The strength and the weakness of the question is that it seems to put the weight of responsibility on the one asking it, to supply an answer from his or her own private and probably inarticulable resources. As a consequence, those who take the meaning of life question the most seriously seem to turn the question around and make it less a question of abstract moral theorizing than a question of personal commitment. As earnestly characterized by Viktor Frankl, he has a book called Man's Search for Meaning, the question of the meaning of life seems to transform from a common question about human life to a personal question about finding one's unique vocation. Here's Frankl describing the challenge of life under conditions of extreme suffering. He was in a concentration camp. We needed to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead think of ourselves as those who were being questioned by life, daily and hourly. Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and right conduct. Life ultimately means taking the responsibility to find the right answer to its problems and to fulfill the tasks which it constantly sets for each individual. Continuing with Frankl, these tasks, and therefore the meaning of life, differ from man to man and from moment to moment. Thus, it is impossible to define the meaning of life in a general way. So even for Frankl, concerned as he is with helping to find meaning in the face of what could so easily seem meaningless, the question of the meaning of life admits of no general answer and is not even the right question to ask. Is the question of the meaning of life even a meaningful question? That was asked by positivist philosophers, who in their eagerness to identify truly scientific questions, capable of verification by empirical observation, dismissed whole classes of inquiry as meaningless. The positivists were right, in a way. The question of the meaning of life is a meaningless question. But in recognizing that, they were not so much announcing a new discovery as springing a trap that they themselves had set. The trap was the dismissal of all moral evaluation as merely the expression of personal feeling. This, what I've called the positivist trap, was built with the materials inherited from their predecessors in modern philosophy. The key figure in this story, as in so much else of modern philosophy, was David Hume. Hume embraced and made others to face the inevitable consequence of the rationalist view of instrumental reason, that the mind cannot know the purposes or natures of things, even whether there are such things as natures or purposes of things. And so There's no science of anything, and certainly no moral conviction grounded on knowledge of what things are. Given the continued power and success of the actual practice of science, it was only a matter of time before someone made the positivist move in response to Hume, recharacterizing science, formerly thought of as pursuing the natures of things, as the formulation of empirically verifiable laws, with the concomitant relegation of evaluative judgment of all sorts, moral, aesthetic, and theological, to the expressions of feelings, technically irrational and meaningless. Through much of modernity, even through early positivism, the question of the purpose of life was so powerful as to reassert itself, even as the conception of reason grew ever more antithetical to it. Pascal responded to early modern conceptions of scientific rationality, showing its limits in light of the reasons of the heart, and even co-opting instrumental reason, as he does in his wager, to reassert the question of how one is to live. Kant resisted Humean skepticism, trying valiantly to relocate ethics, metaphysics, and even religion itself within the scope of rational inquiry. And as we have seen, in response to the positivist conception of reason, Kierkegaard embraces the irrationality of religious faith as the very sign of its superior sort of truth. But in doing so, in accepting the positivist conception of rationality, Kierkegaard so subjectivized the question of purpose as to frame it in new terms, no longer as an intelligibly grasped purpose or goal or chief good of life, but as a personally felt and extra-rational meaning of life. I think these questions suffice to show that the emergence of the question of the meaning of life is not just a trivial semantic shift, superficially covering the persistence of a common underlying question within a stable, coherent conceptual framework. The shift in formulation of the question embodies a shift in the actual question being asked, which reflects a dramatic change in the general conceptual framework assumed by those questions, a dramatic change in the assumptions made about the world, about the human condition, about rationality, and about the kinds of questions that can be intelligibly asked. The question of the meaning of life is just not, and should not be confused with, the question of the end of man or the purpose of life. The two questions entertain different sorts of answers, give rise to different associated questions, and make different assumptions about the nature of man and reality. Now, in the face of this realization, it seems to me that an historically informed philosopher has a few options about how to proceed in talking about these two questions and their relationship. Option one, we could ignore the differences and continue acting as if the new and old questions are really different versions of the same question. This seems to have been the default approach, but in light of what we've covered, I don't think it's any longer tenable. Option two, we could celebrate the shift, embrace the new question, bid good riddance to the old question. Presumably there are some who would embrace that option, and I would leave it to them to defend it. That's not my position. Option three, we could find the new question problematic and recommend not asking it and work to recover the old question. My argument so far has pointed in this direction. But there is another choice. Option four. We could believe that the old question is more important and fundamental, but recognize that the new question, the question of meaning, seems to have significant cultural purchase. And we could therefore attempt to use the new question of meaning, not so much to answer it, as to reawaken the old question of purpose. In practice, I think this last option has similarities to the third and the first options. It seeks to recover the old question, that was my option three, but it might involve treating the new question of the meaning of life as if it were just the latest formulation of the age-old question. That was the naive version, option one. Not out of an ignorance of the difference between the two questions, but out of a calculated rhetorical strategy. This fourth approach of using the newer question of meaning to redirect people to the classical question of purpose is suggested by a review of the development of Catholic evangelization and moral teaching in the 20th century. I won't try to cover that development in full. But we can trace a central relevant thread in the development of Catholic social teaching. The standard story of this development begins around the time of the rise of the notion of the meaning of life. Leo XIII's encyclical, Rerum Novarum, was published in 1891, right? It's the end of the 19th century. Kierkegaard and Tolstoy have had their say. And it sought to address the challenges of new arrangements in capital, labor, and state authority after the Industrial Revolution, many of the cultural circumstances that also gave rise to existentialism. The language of life's meaning makes no appearance in this encyclical, nor anywhere else in the writings of Leo XIII, and he wrote a lot. And he read a lot of philosophy. Instead, one finds what one would expect to find, which was the traditional language of human teleology. The document speaks of the ultimate purpose for which we were made and of man's chief good, the summum hominis boni. 40 years later, in the next milestone document of Catholic social teaching, we still don't find any reference to the question of life's meaning. Again, squarely located in the frame of the question of the purpose of life, Quadragesimo Anno, published in 1931, speaks in terms of man's final end and ultimate good, an end intended by God, who is our last end or supreme end. Quadragesimo Anno specifically singles out socialism's failure as ignoring man's last end. That was 1931. But 60 years later, with the publication of John Paul II's Centesimus Annus in 1991, that's the 100th anniversary of Leo's encyclical, we notice something very different. Here, the language of the meaning of life appears clearly and unmistakably. Early on, the encyclical says, different cultures are basically different ways of facing the question of the meaning of personal existence. Echoing in a new key Quadragesimo Anno's insight that false ideology ignores man's last end, John Paul II continues, but the true cause of the new developments was the spiritual void brought about by atheism, which deprived the younger generations of a sense of direction, and in many cases led them in the irrepressible search for personal identity and for the meaning of life. Later, John Paul II describes Marxism as an inadequate attempt to respond to a genuine sense of alienation, an alienation characterized as a loss of the authentic meaning of life. Thus, continuing the critique of atheism and economic ideology begun in the predecessor documents, Centesimus Annus nonetheless redescribes it in terms those documents never used, in terms of the question, quite new to Catholic teaching, of the meaning of life. John Paul II's adoption of the language of life's meaning did not begin with Centesimus Annus. It appears in many of his earlier papal writings. I found it in Redemptoris Missio of 1990, Salvifici Doloris 1984, Familiaris Consortio 1981, Catechesi Tridenei 1979. He used it in his visit to America in 1979, addressing students at the Catholic University of America. And in 1990, 100 years after John Henry Newman's death, John Paul II described Newman as urging us to keep asking the deeper, more basic questions about the meaning of life and all of human history. Newman, remember, never spoke about the meaning of life in those terms. Indeed, I think it's fair to say that it's characteristic of John Paul II's papacy that he embraced the question of the meaning of life and worked consistently to integrate it into the framework of Catholicism's classical question of the purpose of life. The meaning of life appears in his three other major encyclicals of the 1990s. In Veritatis Splendor of 1993, he introduces moral reflection as mankind's journey to discover the meaning of life. He even takes Matthew's story of the rich young man asking, "What good must I do to have eternal life?" as a question about the meaning of life. Evangelium Vitae of 1995 laments those factors that have diminished the question of the meaning of life, seeks to renew that question, and presents Christ as offering the fullness of the answer to the question of the meaning of life. Fides et Ratio, 1998, makes the question of the meaning of life the central question of philosophy, and all of its recommendations about the renewal of philosophy and its relationship to faith depend on the meaning of life being a live question. While the encyclical lists other more traditional questions of human purpose, it treats them all as expressions of a quest for meaning, even assimilating Plato and Aristotle and the Delphic exhortation, "Know thyself," to this quest. Know thyself. That's not find thy meaning. Know thyself. They're different questions. But John Paul II's doing something, isn't he? Finally, there's the Catechism of the Catholic Church, 1994, revised in 97. The organizing principle still keeps in mind the classical question, with parts on the life of man, the natural human desire for God, and beatitude as the final end of man. And yet, in many individual passages, these are articulated in terms of the quest for the meaning of life. There's even a new Latin term that had to be used because all of these encyclicals have an official Latin version, right? The sensus vitae, the meaning of life, a quest that only Christ can satisfy. If John Paul II had abandoned or showed a lack of understanding of the classical question of purpose, if he had rejected its moral implications and metaphysical framework, we should be very suspicious of his embrace of the meaning of life question. But in all of the cases just described, I would say that John Paul II's consistent strategy is a creative reimagining of the question of the meaning of life, an attempt to rejuvenate the classical question of the purpose of life. Rather than accept the implications of its native intellectual context, subjectivism, metaphysical skepticism, and the narrowing of reason, he makes the meaning question redirect the mind to more fundamental questions of human nature. This is consistent with other ways in which John Paul II recognized the anxieties of secularism, and rather than condemning, found opportunity to evangelize. The modern existential question of the meaning of life is so pressing and so frustrating, precisely because human nature is not such as to be satisfied by asking it, but must find in it a more fundamental question, one capable of leading us back to God. We may take just one representative passage from Centesimus Annus to illustrate. In what I'm about to read, notice how, drawing rhetorical strength from association with a saint and another pope, John Paul II links the meaning question to traditional metaphysical questions about man's origin, nature, and destiny. It's just a short paragraph in Centesimus Annus. "The Church receives the meaning of man from divine revelation. In order to know man, authentic man, man in his fullness, one must know God," said Pope Paul VI, and he went on to quote St. Catherine of Siena, who in prayer expressed the same idea, "In your nature, O eternal Godhead, I shall know my own nature." A footnote gives further license to the question of meaning, citing Paul VI again, from 1965 at the close of the Second Vatican Council. Here's what Paul VI said. "The Catholic religion is man's life because it determines life's nature and destiny." There's the old question. "It gives life its real meaning." The new question. "It establishes the supreme law of life and infuses it with that mysterious activity which we may say divinizes it." The reference to the Second Vatican Council grounds John Paul II's use of the meaning of life question, and it was likely there that the question entered the official discourse of Catholic teaching. It appears clearly but modestly in Gaudium et Spes, 1965, to which John Paul II contributed as Carol Butia. And before that, it appeared in Lumen Gentium, 1964. I don't think Wojtyla had anything to do with that one. But as with John Paul II's encyclicals, both of these documents speak of the meaning of life in the context of affirming the importance of understanding man as made in the image of God and Christ as revealing the fullness of truth about human life. In other words, in terms of the classical question of the purpose or ultimate end of life. On the face of it, the development of Catholic rhetoric about ultimate human questions seems to complicate my characterization of how different the question of the meaning of life is from the older question of human purpose. Vatican II and the papacy of John Paul II seem to be powerful counterexamples to my original claim that the question of the meaning of life should be regarded as a departure from the truly fundamental questions of human life. But the case of the development of Catholic teaching on this matter, which deserves to be studied in greater attention than I've given it here, looks to me like the exception that proves the rule. It confirms that the proper question to ask about life is a moral question linked to a metaphysical question, the question of the chief good or ultimate end of human life. The question of the meaning of life cannot be left to its own native implications of subjectivity and individualism, but can only be adopted as a relevant question if it is brought back within the orbit of a more substantive, moral, and metaphysical perspective. Earlier, I suggested that the question of the meaning of life may fade on its own, and that this would be no great loss, as it had effectively displaced the classical question of human nature and destiny, so central to Western history, and in particular to Christian faith. Now I can say, if the question of the meaning of life does survive, it will be thanks in large part to the development of Catholic theology, and particularly thanks to John Paul II. But then, if the question of the meaning of life has a future, it is not because John Paul II simply and naively embraced a new question as it had emerged in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but because he used that new question to point back to and renew an earlier, more fundamental question. He reinterpreted the newer question of meaning in terms of the more classical question of purpose, and he used the newer question to reanimate that more classical question. John Paul II's creative revision, then, confirms that the question of the meaning of life is indeed, on its own terms, a dead-end question, in need of translation back into a very different and truly timeless question, for it to play any effective and fruitful role in human life. So go ahead. You may ask about the meaning of life. But if in doing so, you are not in fact asking about the origin, nature, and destiny of human beings, then you are not asking in the right way, and, which is more tragic, you will cut yourself off from being able to answer. Thank you.